All right, so this has relatively little to do with turbulence, but I've been interested in how insects fly. So I thought maybe I'll tell you a little bit about what I found so far. So insects, of course, are remarkable. They are, you've seen them, and they can take off in a little second, and they can turn, they can fly backward and forward as well, and hover. So I'm curious why, how they managed to do that. There was also a sort of a historical reason. There's a sort of, in some senses, a nuisance that there's a myth about insect flight, you know, and about 40, 60 years ago, and some engineer calculated and back through a bit of back of the envelope calculation by applying classical aerodynamics to insect flight and claimed insects cannot fly.
And lifting line theory?
Yeah, basically it's a very simple lifting line theory based on is a quasi-steady analysis, meaning the force is given by the velocity squared times the size of the thing, and he claimed it couldn't fly. And so, of course, that itself, the story itself, it wasn't really, particularly exciting or surprising because the model itself was extremely simplistic, and you expect to get wrong answers. But what intrigues me a little bit more is the fact that myth itself hasn't been completely put to rest after all these years. So there's some subtleties about setting the story straight. So I'd like to convey some of the complexities of insect life here. So to begin to think about that, we'd like to first try to get a sense what insects do in air.
Can you turn the board light on?
So this is a picture taken by Ellison, who's done many work in this area. And so this is basically a snapshot of insect flight by using a fast speed camera. And you have different frames. In this particular case, the insect is hoverfly, which is using a typical hovering stroke called a fiddle of eight. Okay, so I'll demonstrate this for you. But the idea of showing this particular sequence to you is that a large class of insects use this particular stroke called VA. There are other tiny little insects use somewhat different strokes, which is a famous one being clap and fling by rice ball. So in this case, I was unable to find a biologist, so I thought what I can do is to sort of animate the sequence to get a better feel. I have to find my video. So basically now I want to show you, this is a bit hard to see, just to show you that was the original data.
Can we turn on the light?
Okay, so this is an old tape. This is just cutting these frames and animate it. So now you can see the insect in motion. So the wing does two kinds of things. One is sweeping back and forth, and at the same time it twists about the spanwise direction, so to pitching up and down depending whether it's sweeping forward and backward. And the idea, of course, is to adjust the angle of attack so it's favorable in both cycles. Okay, so this is a typical motion. So I hope this is clear. So if not, imagine this is a wing, right? So normally you, so for an airfoil, here's a wing, right? So if you have a fixed angle of attack, you just move forward, right? But in this case, the wing sort of moves back and forth, but it, as it moves backward, it needs to pitch about the spanwise direction so that the angle of attack is still favorable. You still get a lift to be both forward sweep and backward sweep. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The pivot is about the leading edge?
The pivot, yeah, is normally about close to leading edge. So depending on insects, normally what's observed is about one quarter of the leading away from the leading edge. Yeah, roughly. So that's the center. Okay, so that's reasonable, right? That makes sense.
Is where the zero moment is.
That's exactly right. So in the classical
airport
theory,
yeah.
is the zero moment.
Yeah.
So
in your videotape, it actually comes out with the muscle right in the back stroking.
Okay, so what
are
I...
Are you ignoring that? Or?
So, yeah, so for my generic stroke, I'm considering the superposition of two motion. One is translation, and the other is rotation.
I see.
But it's a horizontal plane.
Yeah, it goes off the horizontal plane.
It goes off in the horizontal plane, you can do this, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's right. So if what the case I'll be considering, you can consider this the degenerative case.
Okay, so you're going to neglect that.
Right,
okay.
But you can, in theory, you can cooperate that into it. But this is the simplest generic hovering flapping motion I want to consider. So why can't classical aerodynamics capture the lift of an insect? So I want to focus on the fluid dynamics aspect, of course. So let me just give you some basic idea what we're talking about here. So when we talk about fluid dynamics, think about Reynolds number. So typically, it's open to everyone here, so that's kinematic viscosity. So imagine if we divide the world according to this number, and what you find is, of course, large-sized mammals going to have relatively large Reynolds number, and there's a whole host of small animals, bacteria, and so on and so forth, operating in this low soft flow regime, where there are actually a lot of studies being done that you're probably familiar with, life-speaking flow Reynolds and such. And the reason there are much more work done here is, of course, this is a linear regime, and you can write down, and you can have much more rigorous analysis. But interestingly enough, for typical insects, the Reynolds number is between these two regimes, which implies that both the inertia and the viscous effect be important, and they're going to interact with one another. And moreover, there's no simple theory exists in this regime. Right, so for classical airports, it's essentially an inviscid flow plus some cutting motion. So that's one characteristic. So for a typical dragonfly, for example, the one I'm interested in, the typical tip velocity is on the order of meters per second. And so you can estimate the Reynolds number, and the size is about centimeter in chord. So this gives you on the order of 1,000.
How do I know for L I should put in the depth, the width, rather than the length of the wing?
Yeah, so...
this is just a rough estimate.
This is a rough estimate, and moreover, if you think that the dragonfly has an extremely long stemwise direction compared to the core direction, so it's the the flow structure is more or less two-dimensional, and that two-dimensional would be considering a cut in the cord with your typical picture of airfoil. So this is a reasonable estimate.
But shouldn't the water shedding be the very important mechanism here?
Yes, so that's what we're focusing on.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Dragonflies also flap?
Yeah. No. So dragonfly, the stroke is the same, but there's a parameter, right? So parameter is the where the stroke plane is. So what I demonstrated for you is this horizontal flap, my hover flap. But you can tilt the stroke plane. So what it does is do this. Okay.
So what is the minimum Reynolds number they can still fly?
Right. So. We'll see actually explicitly what that Reynolds number is. Mm-hmm. It's typically above 10.
More the shedding from the blood, but.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it important that it's like a two
wings?
Two wings.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Two pairs of wings.
Two pairs of wings. Okay, so most insects have two pairs of wings, but also there's insects have one pair of wings. Okay? So the zoologists, of course, argue that this is important, which is true for a two pairs of wing insects. The fact that they have two pairs of wings are important. They, in fact, flap out of space, so the qualitative or, picture is that the vortex being shed from the forewing is going to play a role of leading edge vortex for the hind wing, which enhances the lift. Okay, so there's a, such an argument made for two pair of wing insects. But what I like to show is sort of toward the end is in what without the second pair, dragonfly can hover as well. So it's not essential.
In case he gets hurt.
Right, so okay, that's biology. That's biology, so in theory they can hover. So this returns to your question again. So I want to make a contrast between insects and a normal airplane, this classical picture. In this classical picture, of course, the lift comes from the fact there is a net circulation around an airfoil. And as a result, a more intuitive explanation is the pressure is lower on the top and higher below. And so the lift can be, in at least in the classical aerodynamics, can be calculated as the product of the translational velocity and the total circulation. And that gives you second u squared times L. Now the amount of total circulation, of course, doesn't come from the inviscid theory. So what it comes from is what's called the cutter condition. The cutter condition says the flow has to be smooth at this singular point, which is the trailing edge. Okay, so that determines the circulation on the body, and which turns out to be some constant times u times L, and that times u gives you the lift. Okay, so naively one would then apply this steady state theory to an insect, namely by incorporating the fact the velocity now is going to be time dependent, and the angle of attack, which I don't have it, which is in the coefficient, is also going to be a time dependent quantity, and if you put that in, average over time, that gives you what's called quasi steady analysis.
What is capital L?
Oh, sorry, capital L is the core. So this is a two-dimensional lift. You would also times span, but in this case, so this is lift per span. So you can, right? Okay, so this is.
So you're saying lift coefficient is constant.
So the lift coefficient is, so lift coefficient, what I should have written down here is constant C of alpha is not a constant, I'm not assuming it's constant, it's an M, it's sine alpha in the classical theory for small angles. But it's, okay, so what I, so that's
what I'm saying. For non-experts like me, can you say a few more words about the cutter condition?
Okay, so cutter condition is, so the classical airfoil theory is based on a solution for potential flow, which is inviscid irrotational flow. Mm-hmm. Now, solution to that, Laplace equation for a boundary condition is non-unique. Mm-hmm. Okay, so non-uniqueness is hidden in this total circulation. Namely, I can add any amount of total circulation to satisfy the solution. It's still a solution. So how do I determine the total circulation, which is important for this? And to do that is to require the following, that is, by adding a suitable amount of circulation so that the flow field is going to be smooth at the trailing edge, namely the stagnation point coincides with this particular point in your geometry, and so that fits the total circulation. So in a way, you can think of this as an effective way of putting into viscosity in the theory.
I see. Nature wouldn't allow you to go around that corner.
Right.
Okay. But wouldn't you like to make your lift less simply proportional to the upside down L called circulation? I mean, dimensionally it's correct, but I thought the cutter condition was dominantly to say that lift is proportional to circulation.
Yeah. So lift is proportional to circulation times velocity, cross the velocity,
upside
right?
Down, yeah.
U cross omega, total circulation gamma, but how do you fix this gamma? And then if you do a apply the color condition that fits the gamma, gamma turns out to be mu proportional to u, and therefore I have this final result, u squared times the basic and the dimension of the system. Does that answer your question or what that
is? Well, your right hand side is simply dimensionally correct. The physics is that is circulation.
Yeah, that's what I think I mentioned that. That was the velocity times the circulation. Okay, cross product. Okay, so is there any other questions about this? So that's the classical theory, and you can apply this to an insect life naively by doing this quasi-steady analysis, namely replacing U and also the mystical equation, which depends on alpha in the function of time. Okay. But so if you do that, it works reasonably well in a sense. On average, the lift is not too far off what you observe, except in some special insects, for example, dragonfly hovering, especially. So it doesn't work very well in the case of hovering. And so it doesn't work very well, but in some sense, again, as I said before, it seems not entirely surprising because the real flow around an insect look very different from this picture, for example. So one signature is they share a lot of vortices, and these vortices, of course, are unsteady and so on and so forth, and they interact. So the lifts, which are generated on this wing, in some sense, well, depend, and ultimately depend how the vortices are being shed and the subsequent dynamics. So in some sense, if one likes to understand the lift, or the instantaneous lift, for example, on a typical insect, one has to capture the dynamics of separation of vortices. And this sort of is both good and bad news. The bad part is there's no simple theory one can write down as a for separation of vortices, except the kind one can extend from cutter conditions. Okay, so the reason we don't have a simple theory because we need to basically solve that is those equations. So the next question is, of course, as a result of a shedding of the vortices, and then this is reflected on the force of the insect. So just to give you an intuitive idea of what happens when you have a shedding of vortices, right? So we all know, if I go up, I just, I don't have to do this, you know this. So if I just drop this pen, then it will more or less go straight, right? But things will be slightly different if I drop this piece of paper, for example, right? So it's erratic. And the reason it's erratic is because this piece of paper interacts with air, and the air, you can imagine, we don't see it very well, but it pushes the air, so the air, vortices will be shed at the edges, and the vortices will interact with this piece of paper. And so for this piece of paper, I don't have much control, so it goes whatever way it wants, and it, in fact, has a lot of dynamic regime. But for an insect, of course, it more or less learns how to control the flow by flapping, doing the right flapping. Okay. Mm-hmm. So another way of thinking about this problem is we like to learn, in some sense, from insects how to play with these vortices. So for people who haven't thought about insect flight recently, and this is a brief history the study things have led about. So there are a lot of experiments. So people in, say, for example, engineering, they like to they tend to experiment around a mechanic wing, and zoologists have worked out this problem for many years. And so they've looked at the tethered flight, and now they also move down to robotic insect flight. So robotic insect flight is, again, you're taking out, you make it a mechanical wing, and allow this mechanical wing to follow the trajectory to mimic the motion of insects, and trying to see what the forces are and the flow to do the flow measurement. And these are the two probably got most recent public press attention. And so nevertheless, you can imagine it's not an easy thing to measure unsteady vertical flows. Most measurements are done by smoke trajectories, and so they measure streak lines. But recently, people were trying to at least apply PID and CPID, so you can get some idea about vorticity fields. Okay, so now the theory part is relatively, I think it's relatively simple, which was
there's been no theory for 20 years. The last one was
1990. I ignore them because I think they didn't. They basically in the same vein as the quasi-steady analysis. So there's no further things I can apply to one to another. But I don't think that gains much. But there's also, I'm sorry. Okay, so there's also a proof theory, which is you start to, which Ellington?
Experimentalist
Ellington. Yeah, so Ellington is a zoologist, and he's done work in the last 20 years, and he's now well-known zoologist. In fact, this is a Nature paper for which he showed that he appeared on TV and such. The idea here, I think I've said enough about this. So you can do a slightly improved theory by putting in discrete vortices. But the problem with constructing a theory is we don't have enough experimental or computational experience to know how exactly the vortices are being shaped. So the model is not straightforward. Okay.
You only talking about the lift. How about just the handling? The inertial effect, right? Force use acceleration.
Yes.
The diving point is a lot of that.
Right. So you're talking about added mass. The inertia of the wing. So accelerate.
No, I'm imagining that if I accelerate the wing, I'm going to transfer some momentum to the fluid, and there's going to be a force by a third law.
Yes.
And it is negligible.
No, this is equivalent, right? So I think it is.
Well, look, it scales the same way. This is what confuses me. Right?
Okay.
It also will scale the same way, but that famous cross product is missing. I mean, it's different physics.
So the cross product is the momentum basically concentrated in these vortices, the vortices in the fluid.
Right.
And there's also a part which is, I think, termed as added mass, which is the acceleration of the fluid.
Right.
By Newton's third law, you also get an additional force. Okay, so this is a classification or characterization due to the fact sometimes people like to separate these effects, but what I'm going to be considering is if you're going to integrate all the momentum of fluid, right, just do an integration of the change of the momentum fluid, and that gives you the force on the wing. So that integration of total momentum includes both two effects. Both, right? So that will have the contribution to vorticity and also has this linear momentum.
But they would scale very differently
okay.
Then there is some trajectory of the wing,
uh-huh.
Right? Whether it's doing the eight thing,
okay.
And presumably the lift will go as velocity squared.
Yeah.
And but this inertial effect, in one or the other way,
uh-huh.
Is proportional to acceleration. And
right,
there are many ways I can get the same velocity.
Right, okay. So I see, so.
Right.
Okay.
But the way you would design a little robot flapping wings would be very different depending on whether you want high peak velocity or high peak acceleration, etc.
Yeah, that's true.
And they would exercise executing very, very different motions.
That's
so the assumption is that.
So the assumption is, I don't think I'm making, so the assumption is I'm not trying to, I guess, design the way based on these two mechanisms. All I'm going to do is to say, well, it's hard to design the wing dynamics, right, based on these considerations, because you have very large parameter space to experiment in, so it's sort of a headache. So what I think is that the next strategy is to say, insects being doing this thing for a long time, let's observe what the wing dynamics they use, and use that to see if we can obtain high lifts.
Evolutionist.
It's evolution solving the
equation
in some sense. You see what I mean? So if you think of from a design
it's
point
just that all
okay.
This looks logically quite okay. So I assume that they all are calculating or explaining the
order. That's true.
There's
true.
Not that inertial
effect. This part.
So therefore. I was asking whether there is actually understanding in the literature or some argument for why that third law is not an efficient way of flying.
No, I think the third law, what it includes is the circulation part too. It's not separate. Okay, so, all right, so but you are saying the fact that the acceleration, the weight has
the other one goes into acceleration. Okay, never mind.
Okay, but so that's also the change, the derivative of a change of total momentum in fluid. Okay, so then you say that's
force.
That's force. Okay, fine. Okay. So I guess I just want to clarify, at least especially when I talk to zoologists, and they tend to impress me with various contributing factors from biology, which are there, which I appreciate. But to make things a little simpler, let me, for the moment, ignore as many biologists as possible, but trying to come up with a minimal model that will give you highest. Okay, so. Quasi-steady analysis is not good enough, but what will be the next most important factor? And in my view, the most most important factor is the sheer factor that the wing dynamics. You know, we swim with typical four strokes, and so insects, they're all very different, but they want the wing dynamics can be classified into certain classes, so this will be the focus of my study. And to just give you a brief idea what this minimum model could be, is I don't even want to worry about the three-dimensional effect, even though the experimentalist, especially in recent Ellington's experiment, he's observed three-dimensional structure around a robotic model wing and argued that these three-dimensional effects are important for lift, but I have a reason trying to figure out whether two-dimensional hovering motion is enough to generate high lift. Okay. So to do that, I'm going to take the usual way. I'm going to take a cut in the core direction, and assuming this is a relatively long span, has a relatively long span, and this is going to be modeled by the same geometry. And for the ease of my discussion or in the computation, in fact, it doesn't matter from a computational point of view. Any two-dimensional sort of this kind of shape is conformal, so I can just use a thing, ellipse. Okay. So the next thing is this ellipse is going to mimic the motion of insects, so it can have a downstroke with an angle of attack. But typically, I can make this wing to do flapping and hovering motion. So this much is a must.
I mean, with the rounded trailing edge, uh-huh. You have difficulty in setting the separation point.
Okay, that's in theory. That's a problem in theory, but yeah. For me, it's not a problem because I'm computing the Navier-Stokes equation. So I'm not actually, so that's the whole point. And I don't want to use that kind of condition. So the So this brings me to the point that is, in order really to characterize the vortices, what I like to do is to solve the Navier-Stokes equation coupled to the dynamics of this wave. So that takes care of the shedding of the vortices. And so the numerical scheme, so essentially now thinking about the computational work in this case, is you compute the Navier-Stokes, two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation coupled to this same geometry, which is oscillating by prescribed time dependence. So in order to resolve these same tips, one, I, in this case, use a fourth-order numerical scheme, both in time and space. And there are some technical issues when takes care of first in order to make this run.
You also consider translational motion of the...
Yeah, so both translational, so translational and rotational motion.
And the body is rigid.
The body is rigid. So the simplest you can think of. Okay, so the only crucial thing is the dynamics of that one. So this is just one thing one can do with 2D, which is nice, that is, for any conformal geometry, you can put a conformal grid, in this case, elliptic coordinates, and which can be mapped to nice rectangular coordinates. And the reason for doing that is so that you can write down the equation, Navier-Stokes equation, in the new grid system with the constant coefficient, so you can have the numerical efficiency. Okay, so I don't want to get into too much detail, but just let me show you that whether we should trust a code like this. So ideally, you like to compare the computational results with experiments. And many people have done that, of course, in the past, and typically you look at the shedding frequency or look at the lift and so on and so forth. But looking at the shedding frequency, as you know, the shedding frequency, the Struan number, is very insensitive to Reynolds number. So just about any computation you do, you probably get a very good agreement with the experiment. So ideally, you would like to have a sort of a time-dependent velocity field in space and time and compare that with numerics. But that's a very tedious thing to do, so not very many experimental data available, but there's a really a nice and careful experiment done in the 80s by these two French people. So this at least shows, so here's the experiment, which is shedding of a pair of vortices behind a cylinder, a classical case. So what they've done is they did a careful measurement of velocity field along the symmetric axis. So they basically take one spatial dimension and look at what is the velocity field along this line as a function of time. Right? So that's a very key thing to do, but they did a very careful measurement. So this is the experimental data. So different symbols corresponding to different time, and this is plotting the velocity as a function of x. And so, but for this experiment, there's only one parameter, that's the Reynolds number. So we can compute that. And so this is a computation, which, okay, so if you look very detailed, you can see some deviations, but by and large, it seems to agree with the experiment reasonably well.
That's why it's increasing Reynolds.
This is the increasing time. So this is for fixed the Reynolds number at different times. So it's an unsteady flow. Right, because the vortex grow and
this is a startup problem.
Yeah, startup problem. So it's a startup problem, and you look at the evolution of this vortex pair, and this is the experiment. So that's one kind of comparison one can do, and there are other standard comparisons.
Can I ask a very naive question?
Okay.
You keep talking about vortex shedding.
Yeah.
What is the technical definition of shedding? At what point does the vortex actually shed?
Okay, so...
shed rather than it's still attached to the wing?
So I think this is a flow separation, right? So in the sort of a steady state picture, you can think of, so let's say stream function is still a good description. So what you find is, I think it's best probably to think about a corner flow. For very low Reynolds number, you typically have this creeping flow, which is solution to the Laplace equation. It's just one region, right? right? So have the, some higher Reynolds number. And so in this case, I guess you can think of the two regions and the flow being separated in two regions. So this is a picture for, so similar picture you can draw for a cylinder. Again, this is the classical potential flow where there's no vortices at all, but as you increase the Reynolds number, appear vortices being separated. And moreover, there's a criteria, at least, so here you have adverse pressure, so that's more technical. You have
so there's a critical, field. Critical Reynolds number.
Critical Reynolds number, and then you'll create this pair. But technically, what happens if you measure the vorticity field along the cylinder, this is zero, positive.
You could also view it as a stability problem, right?
Okay.
Yeah, you can find stationary solutions to this problem, and then at a certain Reynolds number, those stationary solutions are unstable.
Okay.
So you can think of it that way.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So this is just numeric, and I don't have time to show you all the tests, but I guess that I just have to keep myself in check, namely whenever there's an experiment, one likes to see whether how that compares with the computation. But so coming back to inkset flash, so now in we have this computational tool in some sense, and now I can play with vortices. So to begin with, I can find out what will happen in the simplest case. That is, I have a starting flow, and here's a wing which impulsively started downward, and see what kind of vortical structure I have in this case. Or I can play with angle of attack, right, to see how the leading edge and the trailing edge vortices play. And more interestingly, I'd like to show you, in fact, for this talk, I'll focus on the two cases where, in this case, the wing sort of flapping up and down and moving forward. So that's a typical forward flapping case. And the second case will be the extreme motion case, that is, there's no main flow. Okay, so in this case, there's a main flow. You either have a head wing or the fact that the insect flaps forward. Okay, and in this case, there's no main flow. Okay, so that's an extreme case where things are a little bit more interesting in covering. So maybe just to again show you a picture, give you some idea of what vortices are like. So in this case, the simplest case, you have a wing which impulsively starts at time zero, and what I like to see is how the vortices evolve around the tip. Well, first thing you saw is the vortices will grow, right? Grow in time. And two, there are two vortices. This is the leading, and this is really no leading and trailing, but it's a pure vortice. Okay. And this seems to be a very simple picture, but what it says is at least there is an intrinsic time scale in this picture, right? So it takes a certain time for this pure vortex to grow. So that's something quasi-steady analysis couldn't take into account. And two, what was missing in the simple analysis which I've shown before, which is the cutter condition. The cutter condition which applies normally to one edge, right, the trailing edge. So it tells you how much vortices is being shed at trailing edge, but it has nothing to tell you about the leading edge. So even in the simplest level, you realize two things. There's a time scale and there's a leading edge vortex. No? Okay, so
it's a reference geometry.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So,
but what is the?
But I'll show you a picture, which this is.
Returning to this velocity versus acceleration, what is the force as a function of time here? You saw it impulsively,
So
all acceleration is in that first.
Right. So, in fact, that's not the important part. So, let me go back to let me just answer your first question, right? So this is a picture of the, leading edge and the trailing edge, but that was a special case. So typical force, if you just look at this case, and this is a this is acceleration you were talking about. Because it's impulsive, it started. So what you have is a large acceleration. That's a false acceleration because of my, the way I impose the problem.
Yes, yeah, so that's also, so we just...
But that has nothing to do with...
Or,
No, this is not, this has nothing...
The first,
So this list is not something I'm interested in, right? Because that's not the list which is going to sustain. It's just the impulsive start corresponding to this false acceleration. No, but...
You could have chose to resolve it. And
yeah, I could choose to resolve it by ramping it up.
Precisely.
Ramping it up by linear acceleration, which is true if I do a real flight start,
right,
which is a sinusoidal, you start
right
from zero. Okay, but this is just not a standard example to do.
I'll wait till then and ask again. In the meantime, what's the characteristic time?
Yeah, so the characteristic time is about one meaning the length is the core, time is the final velocity. So that's the time scale in the system. Right, so you need a time, length, and a velocity. Alright, so that's the time scale. So I wasn't planning on dwelling into this, getting too very deep on this, but I guess the 2 points which I raised was there's a time scale in the system. There's also a peer vortices in the system. And the question is, where do they manifest in insect flight? Okay. So I want to show you an example that if you ignore these two things, you may not be able to explain at least one of the things which seems to be interesting. Okay, so this is a data which I got from Greenwald. Sorry, I forgot to put the name. He basically compiled all the available zoology, the measurements for different insects. So typically, the data are usually has a lot of scatter, as you see here. But what he compiled here is the wing beat rate versus the wing length. Okay. Okay. So for different symbols corresponding to different group of insects. So if you take a leap of faith, you can say, okay, let's put some line there, and they look reasonably inversely. So the wing beat is inversely related to wing length.
That's a log.
So this is this looks like a log plot, right?
So it's the power log.
Yeah, so it's 1/1. The power is 1. So the rate is proportional to 1/1 wing length.
Okay.
Okay.
So something the maximum velocity.
Yeah, I don't know actually. So that's why you could account for these scatter by, say, rescaling with velocity and so on and so forth. But at least this is the zoologist's way of interpreting data, and they say this is, at least there's a trend, right? So the wing beats, mainly for smaller insects, you have high speeding frequencies, such as we know, mosquitoes beat very fast, more so than dragonflies, for example. Okay? That's clear. So this kind of data, it doesn't come from the classical theory. So if you just do a simple calculation, which is, let's say if you have an airfoil or a wing which moves forward and moving up and flapping up and down, there's a classical calculation by Flowers in the 1930s, and he can predict, he can show you, giving an analysis of what will be the thrust as a function of, say, flapping frequency, right? So from that, you can sort of deduce, in fact, the slower you flap, the more efficient it will be. So in that sense, there's really no mechanism for selecting any frequency in that model. Does that make sense?
Well, the strength of the vortices is larger.
I think so. One you can think of that. So in his model, basically, you have a trailing wake of trailing vortices, right? So it's a linear theory. So the strength of vortices, the ultimate strength of vortices will depend on the frequency. because that, well, I'll give you a physical picture.
The wing is moving up and down and tilting at the same time? Is that
no, this is just the wing is moving and up and down and forward.
And forward, that's all.
That's all.
So what is this U of T at this angle?
This is just, yeah, so this is a little bit misleading, right? So in my case, or you can think of the case I'll be interested in is...
Oh, it's just up and down. Okay.
Yeah, just up and down. But this is a more generic case. And so the wing gets a thrust by shedding a wake of vortices, and so by conservation of momentum, you get a force or thrust on the wing. So the picture you would like to think is if you flap the wing, and if there's a head wing, there's actually a thrust instead of a drag. Okay, so... but if you actually compute the forces using the Navier-Stokes equation, which is to take into account both the fact that vortices are growing and there's a leading and a trailing edge vortices, you can show that the average forces or average thrust, so this is a time-dependent thrust, but if you take an average, you can see, so by counting the peaks, you know which one's faster and slower. So I'm having four different cases. So if you take the average of that, one can show that the average thrust increases with decreasing frequency, but then eventually decreases again. So this is in contrast to the classical model. What you have is, so there are different parameters. This is the frequency. This is the average thrust. So by varying frequency, you increase the average thrust, but then as you keep decreasing the frequency, the thrust drops again. So in classical theory, you would have a line something like this. So but at least, even though the peak is not sharp, but at least indicates that there seems to be a selected, selected is a subject term, a selected frequency at which the average thrust is large.
Okay. Is this based on your computation?
Yeah, that's based on computation. So we want to, so one likes to reconcile these two pictures.
But the frequency of shedding is not the frequency of force.
No,
yeah, it's
different.
And this is with the head
wing. With the head wing, meaning have the average forward velocity.
Right.
Right. So
how
why?
Does it depend on it?
How does it depend on?
Yeah, so if the forward velocity goes to zero, what happens to it?
Yeah, so so then this is the one way of taking them into hovering, right? So the forces will be very different, but I didn't look that carefully. Okay, so in fact, as you go down to hovering, you want to change the strategy, which is what the inference has done. So let me just give you a simple physical picture, and that is what's happening, trying to explain where this, frequency selection comes from. And there, basically, as I was trying to emphasize before, there's an intrinsic time scale for a given Reynolds number and a geometry. So that means, well, it takes time to grow up here, obviously. So these are the three, say, three different frequencies and a wave of vortices being generated. And in addition to this wake, of course, you see the dynamics here of the leading edge vortex. Okay. So this is a cartoon picture corresponding to these three pictures. So in one case, is you, if you imagine yourself flapping this wing rapidly, what happens is in each cycle or each flap, it doesn't have enough time to allow the growth of this trailing edge vortex, therefore corresponding to a slightly smaller force. And in this case, if you flap slightly slower, so you allow the growth of vortices, so you can increase the force as you decrease the frequency. But something happens when you keep doing this. At one point, the leading edge vortex will be separated because if imagine yourself, if you just slap this wing continuously, the leading edge vortex will eventually be separated. So the separation of leading edge vortex provides the cutoff for the time scale. Right? So between these two effects, one can imagine there's a window of frequency where the insects
or the
forward
flapping
has a large thrust.
Is there
a
uniform flow?
Yeah, that's a uniform flow.
Right, impulse.
Okay, so this is just to give you an idea that in the simplest case, in the quasi-steady analysis, there's things missing which you can't, this isn't, for example, a typical example, if you just use the classical theory, you can't explain some of the observations, but the fact is just by taking into in fact, in retrospect, a rather straightforward physical consequence, such as the time scale of the vortex shedding and the behavior of the leading edge that vortex, then one can understand, at least I think one can understand in this particular case a frequency selection. By the way, this is this implies that the selective frequency scales as the wavelength inversely. Okay. But that's just in some sense an exercise, yeah? Okay. Oh, 5 minutes, okay. So, alright, so this is actually the most interesting case which I intended to talk about. Okay, so hovering motion is, as I mentioned before, is the extreme case of forward flapping, which is there's no main flow, so if you just close your eyes trying to think what kind of, when the insect is moving its wing back and forth, what kind of flow structure around this wing might be. One possibility is might be very messy if you just do an arbitrary periodic motion, because you keep coming back to the vortices which were shared previously. And so the conceptual question is, how do they get rid of these vortices? And secondly, this is the case when quasi-steady analysis is worse, so one can ask, at least in this simple case, if you just solve the Navier-Stokes equation, will you get enough lift, right? So in the simple model. Okay, so the dynamics that I showed before, it's heating and a pitching, right? So this is a cross-section of the wing, and the wing extends out from the board. And the parameters which are used here are based on the observation of dragonfly flight. Okay? So it's, of course, the best thing is, actually, let me show you the computational results. So in fact, you can now do an exercise in your mind, see what kind of vortices you might expect in this computation.
Fast-forward.
This is a hovering case.
It's fast-forward.
Oh, it's fast-forward. That's what I'm trying to do, yeah. Okay. Is something wrong here?
It's plain.
Oh, it's plain?
No, it isn't.
It isn't. Oh, I said plain. Is this there? It was to be something before that. Over here. Well, maybe there's nothing left, yeah?
Good, good.
You touched fast forward, so it may have gone to the end of the tape.
I see, for a while. I see. Yeah. Oh, here we go. All right, so remember this is the motion which you saw before. And the so the red and the green are a pair of vortices being thrown out by the wing, okay? So just by looking at this, you can expect maybe there's force on this wing, right? So if you look a little closer, what you see is that a pair of vortices being shed by this translational motion, and by this pitching, it sort of throws the pair of vortices downward. Okay, so that's the sort of a leading water, I think, is a leading water picture in this kind of hobbling, which, okay, so what does it mean? So first of all, it is way of looking at why one want, why does that, why this kind of stroke is good, right? So you need, so you like to throw the momentum of fluid downward in order to get a lift. In this particular case, as I said before, there's no main motion, so you have to create a main flow somehow. And the way to create the main flow in this case is by this induced dipole pair. Okay, so the induced dipole pair has two good things about it. One is it has a downward momentum, and because of this downward momentum, it carries itself away from the wind. Therefore, the previously generated vorticity no longer interacts with this wing, and you expect a periodic force on the wing, which is very nice because for hovering, and if you want to have a quick takeoff, then this is the situation you would like to have. And so let's just take a look at the force on this wing. So now you can, of course, measure lift and drag, and so I happen to have two Reynolds number, but you can do as many as you like. So this is a typical lift over about, say here, about 10 periods, and this is drag. So what you then can do is, so first thing you observe is, I should plot from zero. So the first thing you observe is, it doesn't take more than two periods to become periodic force, because, at least intuitively, this is what's happening, because it's only takes one period to get into this periodic mode. And two, the question then becomes, what is the average force for this generic hovering? So if I take an average over, say, 50 periods, just to get an estimate, so the lift per unit span, that I'm doing a two-dimensional lift, so that's per unit span, you can come up with a number, and this is what I have for this particular case, and you can have a thrust and so on and so forth. So then you can compare that with a typical driver's like weight, okay? And so it turns out the conclusion is that in this simple model, you can create a lift which is sufficient to support a typical dragonfly wing. Yeah. Which is, I think
it's... But if you cut off one pair of the wings, you wouldn't find them, right?
Yeah, you cut off...
0.22
versus that. Right. Okay, so that's... How many things I've ignored this so far, too? Yeah,
but you can do that experiment.
Right, so...
And if you look at the time dependence of your cycle, does it correlate with peak velocity or peak acceleration?
I see. So I haven't looked at, but it's actually okay. So it's actually somewhere you can happen to look at this. So the quasi steady state I use is U squared, right? U squared. So acceleration is the phase of the cosine. So it's close enough to the peak rather than pi over 2. Because
so peak of what?
Well, so peak of velocity squared, right?
So it's closer to the peak of velocity.
Yeah. So the other one would be pi over 2.
May I ask a question? Mm-hmm. I mean, you usually use lift and drag with, relative to the free stream direction.
Yeah.
But there's no free stream direction.
So this is a misnomer in some sense. This is a lift in my case. This will hover precisely as you said, because there's no preferred direction. So yeah. I have to define with respect to one direction, which is gravity. So lift in my case is vertical force versus the horizontal force. So I then decompose the usual definition with respect to the free stream back to the x and y direction. Okay, so this is just definition.
And then
drag is in the horizontal direction.
True.
Okay, so,
Or if you choose the kind of motion that you apply, and can you optimize that?
Yeah, so next question is, okay, again, so just by looking at this picture, one thing sort of jumps at you is that the phase of the coupling between the translation and rotation is important. because that will change the direction of the jet, and that will, depending on that, you may not even have this jet, you may have a mess, right? So if you just start arbitrary periodic function. Okay, so then one can play, do a, you know, at least within this class of model, you can do a systematic study such as, so I have written, imagine, you can imagine there's a sinusoidal motion, and so there's a phase between the two motions, you can vary the viscosity, you can vary amplitude, and so on and so forth. And this is an old result, but I have a better result where you can systematically sweep through the parameter in this case and find optimal length and so on and so forth. Yes, so one can do that.
Why does it need two pair of wings?
What happens?
Why does the dragonfly need two pair of wings?
They don't, in my... So I don't know. So not all insects have two pairs of wings.
In case they're attacked by another dragonfly.
I have a presentation, I told you.
Oh yeah, here is an interpretation of how, why they put it in hand. Why put it in hand,
we can understand.
There is a very difference between the forewing and the hand. And I suppose there's some advantage of difference of pages, this kind of arrangement.
But birds can hover with only one set of wings.
Hummingbirds
are many others that do it right over here.
Yours is for a quasi-steady situation.
So Gustafsson did a computation about in 92, and I don't know if he's still working on that. So it's rather similar, except that his computation, I imagine back then the computer was a little bit slower, so the vortex dynamics, you couldn't see this kind of structure. You can see the vortex, I think, in his paper, so you can see one vortex, so the resolution, at least the face in the old paper, wasn't clear enough to show this the shedding of the dipole structure. But if he does it again, he might be able to see it now.
Yeah, well, from the point of view of induced dipole vortex,
mm-hmm.
This is a very, I call these objects vortex projectiles, you see. And you can see that the fly, or whatever it is, wants to generate a vortex underneath itself.
Right.
By various, he probably senses it, and actually, you know, he fine-tunes it as it's shedding, I would guess.
Uh-huh.
But if you take the axis of that vortex, and see where it is with respect to the central line of the object, you will find it's probably very close to that. And in fact, it's just the counterflow that's providing the lift. Physically, I mean, you didn't explain the physics of it. You said there's an induced dipole and there's a force. But physically, it's just a reverse jet.
I understand that. So,
and in fact, that is the thing that you should measure.
Okay.
In some sense, you should try to see how much that upwelling from the central line of the jet, the downgoing vortex, overcomes whatever is there. There's also another flow going up. So from the point of view of vortex dynamics, you could look at it even without the dynamic, just to see if you can get the right velocity.
What you're saying is the vortex jet itself has a momentum. Huh?
That's right.
So one thing I forgot to measure is why I always use the term vorticity, right? So one way I like to think about this is, well, Newton's third law says the force on the wing is the same as a change of momentum in fluid. And the question is, where does that occur mostly in fluid? And if you, in the implicit theory, you can write down the integral of, say, u cross omega. So that's where the forces being acted, or the change of momentum being acted in fluid. And so in this picture, we'll be mostly concentrated on the dynamics of vorticity. So in this case, right, so if you look at the change of momentum concentrated on this vortex dipole, then that ought to mostly balance the force, which is sort of a different picture from the acceleration of a wing. Okay. So anyway, so this is, at least I think, put a quantitative measure of the forces coming from Navier-Stokes equation, albeit it's a simple model, and this will make the experimentalist think a little bit more, because the experimentalists tend to have these three-dimensional experiments, and they like to argue three-dimensional effects are important, and they might be important, but I'm arguing here they're not essential. Okay, they will have refined. They'll refine the forces, but even without them, you can have a large understanding force. So this is just to show you some of the comparison, which I guess I don't have time to go into. Any other questions? Yeah.
I just to kind of, maybe we should let you conclude and postpone the question.
All right, so on the conclusion, I think I basically said along the way that is, the idea of a resolved computation for the hovering flight is, first of all, I'd like to see whether there is a leading order model or minimal model which captures, which captures quantitatively the unsteady effect. Unsteady effect meaning that how voices being separated and how they interact with one another to give a large lift. And this in turn then will give us ideas about making better theoretical models, which was so far is a simple quasi-steady model, but now I think there are enough evidence to suggest that one has to come up with a reasonable model to include both the leading and the trailing edge vortices, and the question is how do you do that? So that's two. And finally, also I think, just from design point of view, I think it would be somewhat a difficult task if someone hand you a way and ask you to find a simple solution to Navier-Stokes equation so that there's a periodic force on this wing. But by observing what insects have done, they sort of solve the first half of the problem for us, and then we can do the optimization. Okay, so that was... Yeah.
The
lift, right? So this is downstroke. So hopefully you get lift. And this is upstroke. So there's a symmetry. So the total lift is But you can actually do have both lift if you play with the motion. For example, right now I only have sinusoidal motion, but if you actually have a piecewise linear motion where you manage to do the pitching motion at the end of strokes, I believe you can have lift both in upstroke and downstroke.
There's an effort here, presumably, to try to get as much lift with as small an expenditure of energy as possible.
Right.
So that's a variational problem of some sort.
Right, yeah. I haven't done that yet, but do you have any suggestions?
No, I'm just suggesting it's a variational problem.
That's right.
It might be interesting to see how effectively insects probably in effect have solved this problem fairly well.
Presumably, but I don't know the answer.
It's interesting to see.
That's right. Well, the next question was...
that also kind of looks at the physiology. I guess presumably those wings cannot be turned around by 90 degrees, which would presumably be preferential is on the upstroke.
So you mean the constraint from the wing dynamics from the system? Yeah, so there are certain restrictions. So I don't know how do you do the global minimization or whether you want to restrict yourself to the class. So at least in this model, you can ask the question, here I have a class of motion, and what, just for mechanical wing, it has to be one of the questions to ask. Okay. Overrun the time? Okay.
All right.
I wasn't paying. Okay. How do I turn this thing off?
Really?
No, we start. We didn't even start until 40 minutes. You said.
But we interrupted the debate. She was interrupted several times.
Yeah, okay. We both of us got the.
I was relying on you. But for that celebration, I think one can't. Now I understand your question. One can't specifically just look it out.
Because I really come up two facts.
I don't understand your question. The force is. So you have.
Okay, I have a completely stupid question, and they have an answer.
Calculating the flow,
you have everything, but he wants to.
No, of course!
Yeah,
of course,
but he wants
of
to separate which one's what.
But the physics is completely different, you know. One is, steady or quasi steady state lift, the other one is paddling, right? Why can't I transfer some momentum just by accelerating in some sort of way?
But that's what they do.
You get it
backwards.
Right, and I can make same dimensional analysis. I'll take acceleration times length will give me velocity squared, all right? So. But there is a difference because the force will appear in a different.
Yeah, the force. I think in your case, this is
time during with different phase during the cycle, and I suspect that there is some obvious stupidity about trying to.
But that gives you zero, no? If it's proportional to A.
No, of course. This will give zero, but you can do that, right?
Yeah, but it's okay. Well, how would you write? So you think, but acceleration, right? If you have, you can write out a motion. You can write out the linear acceleration.
I'm not a rower. But so my understanding is when you get into the boat with oars, right, you generate force by accelerating you for one. And then you take it out of the water, right?
Well, you could leave it in the water.
Precisely.
And it to
precisely, which is what they do, right?
Yeah.
Which is what they do. Wait. A rower, right,
yeah.
Keeps the oar in the water, but changes the angle of that. But I assume that what they're doing is not generating lift, right? What they're doing is, and sure they're shedding vortices and all the good stuff, but I assume what they're doing is accelerating. Now, why can't the dragonfly do a thing like this? That was my question.
Basically,
that's what they do.
I think the dragonfly is doing that.
It's
pushing that around and it turns.
Well, that's what I thought.
But then
it has to go with acceleration, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Then it has to go with acceleration.
Yeah.
But Jay says it goes with water.
No. Velocity is a way of computing the force. You compute velocity field. You compute velocity field, and you compute all the forces.
I have no quarrel that when she calculates the flow for a particular trajectory, she got it right. I'm just asking for interpretation because interpretation goes strictly, according to the velocity, right? And I don't know ultimately the physics, I suppose, is all the same, right? It's Newton's law. But I think one can distinguish between the steady effect, which goes with velocity squared, and the unsteady effect, which goes with acceleration.
Right, we can separate the two. So imagine if yourself writing force as a function of A. So this couldn't be just by itself. It couldn't be just this. If this is the case, then I can show, at least in one case, where the average of this is zero,
but
U squared is non-zero.
Right, of course.
Okay.
But presumably it would be some integral of A along the trajectory, right? So that one would have and then of course you would have to rotate it. This rotation would be completely essential.
Yeah, but Yeah, so somehow the acceleration of the translational acceleration has to be coupled somehow to the rotation, because each one is,
Absolutely. But you know that the effect will depend on the angle of the back, right?
Right.
There's no question about that.
The even the acceleration part, you think?
Of course.
So, okay, so you decompose, okay, I see.
But I think you will see it just by correlating a force with acceleration and velocity,
yeah.
Right? Because these two things are more or less out of phase.
Right.
And if you're getting a piece proportional to acceleration, right, that's that's a different that's a different beast.
Okay. Yeah. No. I understand.
I have arrived. My name is Matt Beluca. Since I'm a participant in the program, I think I should make my report to the head of the program.
Okay, I think I know.
А может там лучше бой завтра, сегодня просто поздно.
На самом деле я завтра буду в более приятном состоянии.
Замечательно. Хорошо.
Like at 4?
No, I didn't start at 4. You started at 3:30.
No way!
It's okay. It was interesting, and the audience was interested.
Sorry
to keep
you here.
No. I had to tell you just to make you feel a little bit guilty.
Like 5 minutes, I thought,
but after an hour, only after an hour.
I didn't even know that. Okay.